This is The Granite Beat, a podcast where we highlight New Hampshire journalists, ask them about recent stories they've published, and about what it's like to cover their corner of this small and interesting state. I'm Julie Hershan Hart, and I'm here with Adam Drapshow.
Hello.
Today's guest is one of the rising stars of New Hampshire journalism. Beatrice Burak is a junior at Dartmouth College, but her work has already been seen by readers across the state. She interned with the New Hampshire Bulletin and recently wrote a five-part series about skiing in New Hampshire and about how it was once the capital of alpine skiing in North America, to the present state of skiing in low snow winters, and even a peek into what the future might bring. We're excited to talk to you today, Beatrice.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here.
Beatrice, could you tell us when, how, and why you became interested in journalism?
Yeah, of course. So my sophomore year of college, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do for my spring off term, because Dartmouth has a unique schedule where we take a term off, a term that's not the summer term off, and we're told to, you know, go out and do something. And I really wanted to learn more about how state politics worked and how the state house worked and more about state policy. And that sort of led me into looking at the New Hampshire Bulletin. And it seemed like a really wonderful organization. And I knew that it's so important right now for local news outlets to be continuing that work of getting out important information about what's going on in our local political world. And so I ended up emailing them and just sending them my resume and saying, you know, hey, I have zero experience in this, but I'm really interested in the work that you do. And I think that you've done a lot of great things. And I was able to get an internship, which was just a really incredible experience. So that was basically how it all started. And while working there, it was a very hands-on internship. I got to publish articles and work alongside really incredible journalists and learn from them as I went. So when I left there, I ended up being able to do some freelance work in the area, and that's sort of how I got started.
Tell me about the idea for this series. How did it come about, and when did you realize that you had tapped into a five-parter?
Yeah, that's a good question. This actually started as it was going to be sort of a historical research project. I'm a history major at Dartmouth, so that's sort of how my brain usually takes a new project is, you know, can I look at the history of this and see how it came about? And I started planning this project and talking to some professors about working on it, trying to get some funding. And that was around the time that I was finishing up my internship at the Bulletin. And I started to get some opportunities to do freelance writing. And I just realized, you know, that's how I should be doing this. This should become a freelance journalism project. And I knew it was more than just a single article, because I had already been thinking about it sort of in terms of an exhibit, like a historical document exhibit that was going to go up at the library. And that's what ended up happening. And it's up now at Dartmouth Library. But I was thinking about it in sort of six parts, because there are six cases in the exhibit section of the library. So I already had it sort of blocked out that way in my mind. And so that naturally flowed into, well, five articles and then sort of an opening case to the exhibit.
That's really interesting. I don't know if I've ever heard about a journalism project that has been paired with a museum exhibit. That's a really cool way to think about bringing your work into the sort of physical realm. One of the things that you reported that surprised me, and I'm someone who's lived in New Hampshire for more than 30 years, was that this state was once the epicenter of downhill / alpine skiing in North America. Could you explain what you meant by that?
Yeah, of course. So New Hampshire, right around the turn of the 20th century, when skiing was starting to become really popular in the U.S., or starting to become more popular in the U.S. as a sport, as a thing that people would do for fun, New Hampshire, it seemed to be sort of in the right place at the right time. There were Scandinavian immigrants here who were working, you know, up around Berlin in the logging industry, who had brought their knowledge of skiing from where they were coming from in Europe. And then there was also a burgeoning ski movement in Great Britain at the time. So there were a lot of people writing about skiing in the English language. That somehow landed in New Hampshire. I mean, those immigrants were here and bringing those ideas. And those ski manuals were something that Dartmouth students, for instance, were able to get a hold of and learn about skiing from those manuals. So it was sort of a perfect storm, and skiing became more and more of a thing that people did for fun here. There were ski areas that opened up. There were opportunities for people to learn how to ski. And so the tourist industry in New Hampshire, which at the time had been more focused on summer tourism, right? People coming to the White Mountains to see these beautiful mountain vistas in the summer, all of a sudden realized that if they could adopt skiing, they could get their visitors to come year round and they could have a year round source of income. So we ended up being pretty much at the forefront of that new sport in America. And you're right, we're maybe not at the forefront anymore, but we definitely have a really rich ski history in New Hampshire because of that history.
One of the historical details you uncovered was that the state's ski industry has already seen a significant contraction. There are well more than 100 ski areas in the Granite State that closed in the second half of the 20th century. Did you get the sense those were due to the churn of a new industry, or should those be seen as a warning sign for the future?
I think that is another really great question and something that I think I still can't fully answer, but it's definitely a good question to be thinking about. It, as you said, I mean, this is definitely, skiing at the time was still a very new industry. I mean, it's really only about 100 or so years old in New Hampshire. And there was a lot of boom and bust. There still is. There were a lot of ski areas that popped up because, you know, I think someone had the idea that this was a really exciting new way to make some money and get some tourists coming in. And then when, especially when the baby boomer generation sort of got older, all of a sudden there wasn't as much demand for those ski areas. So that's definitely one piece of it. Another piece is, I think, the weather piece. There were a lot of really warm winters that made it tough for some of those areas to stay open. There were also insurance cost issues. So there were a lot of different factors at play. And, you know, some of those factors are still present today. Others are less prevalent. But I think that it can be taken as a warning sign in the sense that, you know, it's really hard to keep a ski area going. There's a lot that goes into it. And so when these things come up, like a warm winter or changes in insurance costs or just a difference in people's appetite for skiing, that can really affect ski areas. I mean, these are not places that are just always going to be around and always with us no matter the conditions. There's a lot that has to go right to keep them going. So I think that's sort of the message that I've taken away from it. Is it a warning sign that all of a sudden we're going to have a ton more ski areas closed? I don't think so, but I think that it is a sign that's something that has happened and that's something that can continue to happen when the conditions change.
And we've certainly seen that this winter as a prime example. One thing that made your series particularly interesting was that you found people for whom skiing isn't just an economic activity, people like Tim Morrill, who's part of the third generation of his family to help run Veterans Ski Area in Franklin, or Ed Warren, a record holder for the fastest time hiking up and skiing down Mount Washington. What's at stake here in terms of culture and identity?
Those are two really, really interesting people to talk to because, yeah, as you said, skiing is such a big part of their lives and is such a big part also of why they live in New Hampshire. And that was really interesting for me to think about because, you know, as we move into an era of warmer winters in New Hampshire, I think that becomes an open question of are people who are really interested in skiing going to choose to live here, or are they going to choose to live somewhere out west or maybe further north in Vermont where there's more consistent snow cover. And I think that a lot of the people that I talked to said that that's starting to become a factor, but most of them said, you know, I've been here in New Hampshire for so long. For instance, with Tim Morrill, you know, my family grew up here, grew up skiing here, and I want my kids to do the same. So there is somewhat of that sense of let's keep this going. You know, things aren't the same as they used to be, but we really value what New Hampshire does have to offer in terms of skiing. And there is also that sense, you know, if you talk to skiers in New England more broadly, but I think especially New Hampshire, it's definitely, you have to be a little bit willing to brave difficult weather and poor snow conditions. And that's always been the case in New Hampshire. I mean, things have not always been prime for skiing, but there is a sense of being ready and willing to get out there and go no matter what the conditions are. And so I think that also keeps people going here and keeps people a little bit more resilient despite warming winters.
If I could offer a counterpoint to that, which actually comes from your own reporting there, is that if there were to be a difficult winter, where particularly one that had low snow with perhaps some other combining factor that would put additional pressure on the industry, it wouldn't be the larger, well-funded ski areas that would really take it the hardest. It would be the smaller ones, the community ones, the ones that are sort of in commuting distance for a ski after work or on a quick weekend day. What would be the danger to the industry if those smaller places were to go away?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Adam. And those are the areas that seem primed to be the most at risk. And we have seen some small areas close down in the last couple of years just because they're not able to open without snowmaking. And it's really expensive for them to have snowmaking. Veterans Memorial, which Tim Morrill runs, is, you know, they were able to open for a very short period of time this winter. And they have two snow guns, but even having that snowmaking, there's so much cost that goes into the energy to run those and the water costs. And so it really is those areas that are struggling the most. And, you know, going forward, there's funding that they can get. I mean, there's support that they can get locally. And we've seen some of those places like Veterans Memorial, like Whaleback, getting government funding to be able to keep running and especially to put up snowmaking. But I think that it's a really tough spot for them to be in, because in order to ski, you need snow. And in order to get snow in this climate, you're starting to need a heck of a lot of money.
Beatrice, I'm wondering what you learned about journalism through this reporting project. Is there anything that you think you'd do differently if you could go back and do it again?
Oh, that's a great question. There's definitely so much I would do differently. I think that the main thing that I learned was just the art of sort of reaching out to someone that you have never met, you might have pretty much no connection with, and convincing them that it would be worth their while to take a couple of minutes or an hour or so to tell them a little bit about their life. And I think that that's such a powerful part of journalism. That's one of my favorite parts of it, is just the ability to have a platform from which to reach out to people who you have maybe no connection with and just talk to them about their lives. And I think that the more that I do that, the better that I get it and making those connections and really having the kind of in-depth conversation with someone that gets you to get to the core of why they really care about an issue or what's really hurting them right now in this moment. So I think that was the biggest takeaway that I had. In terms of what I would do different, I think it was very tough to balance this project with a lot else that I'm doing. I mean, obviously I'm a full-time student. I was actually out of the country in the fall on a study abroad program. So it was a lot of sort of balancing, scheduling interviews from afar, and a lot of when I was able to get out and go to mountains was really when I had time over break. And of course, as you know, this was a very wonky winter. I mean, right now I'm looking out the window at a ton of snow that just showed up here at our doorstep. Of course, after I'd already published this piece, and there were a lot of really tough low snow weeks towards the end of the winter, or what we thought was the end of the winter anyway, March and February, that I just wasn't able to get out and go to resorts for. So I think that if I were to do this again, I mean, I would just have more time throughout the winter to be able to get out there instead of just a couple of truncated weeks of reporting. But those weeks, that being said, were really interesting, because that was when we got a ton of flooding in the state, and I was able to go out and see how that was affecting ski areas.
I found it interesting that this was published in a newsletter called Daybreak, which covers the Upper Valley on both sides of the New Hampshire-Vermont border. Why do you think that was the right outlet for this series? And I'm also curious if you have a view of, more broadly, the role that newsletters are starting to play in our contemporary journalism landscape.
Yeah, so first of all, I think newsletters are great. I mean, I'm always trying to get as much news as I can in the morning before I get going and go to class and do all the things that I need to be doing. And I think newsletters are good because I get it in my inbox and I can scroll through and, you know, highlight a couple of articles that I want to look at later. And it just feels like a much more concentrated way to get my news. And it also helps you pull news from all over the state and helps you find the things that you might have otherwise missed if you were just looking at one paper in particular. So I think that's great. In terms of Daybreak in particular, Daybreak's run, if you don't know, you should definitely go and check it out. You can Google Daybreak Upper Valley, and there's a spot to subscribe on their Facebook page. But it's run by Rob Gerwitt, who himself was a journalist for a really long time and has done some really great reporting for a governing magazine and other places. And he just has a really deep appreciation of local news, and, you know, not just the kind of local news that you would see in the newspaper traditionally. Things like so-and-so saw a bear in her backyard, or look at these wonderful photos of this crazy sunset that we had here in Hanover or Norwich. And I think that he's captured a really special appreciation for this Upper Valley region. And also, you know, he reports on, or he includes news from all over New Hampshire and Vermont, but it's focused on the Upper Valley area. And I think that people really appreciate, and I really appreciate, that it's a good mix of things that are really difficult topics, you know, political topics. He includes New Hampshire Bulletin reporting on what's going on at the State House and NHPR and all these other outlets that we're familiar with, but also just things about the weather and things about small goings on around us that maybe otherwise wouldn't make the news or wouldn't cross our minds, but are a really important part of what it means to live in a small town in a rural area. So that's why I love Daybreak. And I think that this piece aligned well with what he does, or this series aligned well with what he does, because it was so focused on how people in this area view their lives and how things that matter to us shape our lives, and how the changes that we can observe day to day in our climate, in our weather, affect all of that. So I think that's why it lined up well, and I was really glad that he was excited about the series and ready to publish it.
So what do you think is next for you, Beatrice, in terms of journalism? Is this where you're going to turn back and focus on history, or do you see journalism being a part of your career?
To be totally honest, I'm trying to figure that all out. So I'm a junior in college. That feels like the time where you try to take a step back and figure out what it is that you want to be doing for the, you know, foreseeable future, as much as you can predict that in college. And right now I'm definitely taking a step back from journalism to focus on my classes this term. I'm also getting ready to write a history thesis. So that's all something that's probably going to take up a lot of my time going forward. But I know that no matter what I do, I mean, the skills that I've been able to practice as a journalist have just been immeasurably helpful to me. I mean, I talked about the interviewing piece. I think that that's so important, to just have the skills to be able to have a conversation with someone and learn more about their life, even when you might not have a whole lot in common with them. And also just writing, you know, being able to meet deadlines and sort of writing on command and writing in a way that people can understand what you're trying to get across, I think is so important. So to answer your question, I'm still trying to figure it out, but I think that I know that no matter what, all the work that I've done in journalism will absolutely inform what I do next.
Wonderful. And what advice would you give someone, perhaps a fellow student, who's interested in journalism but doesn't know where to start?
I think if you can get an internship with a newspaper, or, you know, even just a journalist, a freelance journalist who you can shadow in any way, I think that is just so helpful. Because I mean, coming into this field, I didn't know a lot about journalism, and I knew that I read journalism all the time, and it totally informs how I view the world, but I didn't really know the behind the scenes pieces of how it all works. And that's why interning at the Bulletin was just so wonderful. I mean, working with Ethan DeWitt and Anne-Marie Timmons and Hadley Barndaller, and I mean, it was just, they're just such great reporters, and it was so cool to be able to follow along in their day and see how their brains work and see how they come up with a story and think about it. And if you can get an opportunity like that, I mean, absolutely, you should go for it. And I think the Bulletin's still offering internships, so definitely look on their website and look into that if you can.
And is there anything that we didn't ask you about that you'd like to share while we're still together today?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the other thing that came up for me in my reporting on this is that I think climate change is a subject that people often think about and then would like to stop thinking about because it's just not all that fun. I mean, it's really a pretty dire prediction in a lot of cases, and it can be really hard to picture what our future is going to look like. And something that I realized while I was working on this project that was a bit of an aha moment for me and probably should have seemed super obvious, but it didn't, was just that there's so much rhetoric around, you know, saving the planet and we have to, you know, go all out and change everything. And I think that what I realized looking at the New Hampshire Climate Assessment, which was done back in 2021 by some scientists, was that, you know, there really are many paths forward. They focused on two paths forward. So there was a sort of lower emissions scenario and a higher emissions scenario. And what that showed was that depending on how much action is taken, you know, by governments, by people, by companies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, you know, we're going to be seeing different weather day to day. You know, we're going to be seeing more rain or less rain and more snow or less snow. And those changes by degrees, you know, those relatively subtle changes can mean a big difference for a ski area over time. They can mean a big difference for the ski industry over time. And so that was something I realized is it's really important not to just look at it at climate change as a binary of, you know, either we address the problem or we don't. But there is a lot of hope when you look at sort of the differences between those different scenarios and you look at what's possible if certain actions are taken. And I think that the takeaway from that for me is, you know, the little things are important and there is some hope for a future that isn't as dire as the projections often suggest.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Beatrice. It was a real pleasure to meet you.
Thanks so much for having me on, Adam. I appreciate it. And it was great to meet you as well.
The Granite Beat is a project of the Granite State News Collaborative in partnership with the Laconia Daily Sun. We record at the Lakeport Opera House, and our theme music is composed by Bob McCarthy. Thanks also to the Marlon Fitzwater Center at Franklin Pierce University for editing and other support.